Hi, everyone. You're listening to Topping the Curve, and this is your host, Sephora Gray. If you're a returning listener, please be sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us on Instagram and subscribe on our website. If you're new here, welcome. I hope you enjoy.
I would say the biggest mistake when you're preparing for the LSAT is not spending enough time studying for the LSAT. So I definitely recommend that, you know, applicants spend at least 6 months to a year preparing for the LSAT before they apply to law school.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Topping the Curve. On today's episode, I have Akeisha Anderson, who is here to talk to you guys all about creating the perfect law school application. So Akeisha, will you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. Hi, everyone. As has already been said, my name is Akeisha Anderson. I am actually a legislative attorney and a criminal justice reform lobbyist based in Montgomery, Alabama. I'm a Montgomery, Alabama native. And so I grew up here and I'm a graduate at the University of Alabama School of Law. But outside of my day job, when I'm not doing criminal justice reform lobbying and working as a legislative attorney, I'm the owner and founder of Anderson Admissions Academy, which is a business designed to help low-income, first-generation, and underrepresented minorities navigate the law school admissions process. And I kind of delved into this realm of doing law school admissions consulting after working as Associate Director of Admissions for UCLA School of Law. So I'm super excited to be here today and to give all sorts of tips and tidbits to help out future attorneys.
Akeisha, wow. I didn't know you were a legislative attorney. That's very interesting and probably another conversation for another day. But just to go ahead and jump right in, can you just talk about what led you to law school and what did you think you wanted to do going into law school?
Yeah, definitely. So prior to law school, I actually worked. So I did not go immediately from undergrad to law school. So prior to law school, I had experience working for some nonprofits, a government agency, my U.S. Congresswoman, as well as my local county commission. I also got my master's degree in public administration, which required me to take a public policy course. And so a combination of my educational background and work experiences led to my love of being behind the scenes of policymaking. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I knew that I wanted to be in the realm long term. And so because a lot of the people that I saw influencing and writing legislation were lawyers, and also because I wanted to understand what felt like an unknown language to me, which was the law, I decided that law school was the next step for me. So that's really what led me to law school. And I had a passion for doing policy work going into law school, which, you know, has led me to where I am currently.
Mm-hmm. And so I was going to say, you know, did you stay true to those goals? But it seems pretty clear that you did. You talked about how you love policy and how a lot of people that you worked with or you saw in those roles were attorneys. And that's essentially why you came to law school. And that's one of the things that you do now. And then the other thing, as you mentioned, was you also run, what was it, Anderson Admissions, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So can you talk a little bit about essentially why you decided to start it?
Yeah. And so to talk about that, I'm actually going to go back to the question about staying true to my goals. So Yes, I did stay true to my goals initially, but when I was in law school and then immediately after I did federal policy work, I was doing LGBTQ rights specifically. And when President Trump became president, it just became a very different landscape. So I went from working in the realm, you know, when the marriage equality case was won and there were all these strides being made in the right direction, in my opinion, for LGBTQ rights and equality, to working in federal policy at a time when the administration was just hostile to the work that we were doing. And so it kind of at that point for me felt like I wasn't doing work in a courtroom, traditional legal work, but I was writing, you know, to the federal administration regularly, but it just felt like I was going to the courtroom every day and taking an L. And so the work kind of became very just depressing, for lack of better terms. And so at that point, I needed a shift in career and I did not know what I was going to do. But at the time, I was working for a think tank at UCLA School of Law. And what ended up happening was there was an opening in another department at UCLA in the admissions office. And so I got a call from somebody from the law school I graduated from, and kind of he just encouraged me and told me I'd be great in admissions and really encouraged me to apply for a job. I ultimately got the job, and it was really the opposite of what, you know, policy work felt like at the time. So instead of feeling, you know, demoralized and like I was losing every day, I now had this fun job where I got to interact with these like really promising, inspiring future lawyers. And it was just very energizing. And so I really loved the work that I did working in admissions. But something that I noticed just while I was doing the work were just some of the disparities between who had access to me. So as an admissions officer, it was my job to basically give advice to anybody that came in front of me, whether you were from California, from somewhere else, a junior, senior, whatever. But I noticed that, you know, the legal profession in and of itself isn't very diverse, but also the people that I often were interacting with weren't necessarily the people that I felt like needed my assistance and my advice most. There weren't really as many people who looked like me that came before me and sat in my office. And those were the people that I really wanted to reach. People that had similar backgrounds to me, people that were low income, first generation, minority applicants. And so anywho, I did end up making that shift from admissions back to policy work, but those gaps still remained in my mind. Just, you know, who had access to admissions officers, who had access to, you know, some of this behind the scene knowledge about how to navigate the admissions process, the things to do, the tricks of the trade. And so just recognizing that that was still a gap and there was still a need for, you know, people with similar backgrounds to myself to have access to that information, I started Anderson Admissions Academy. That is something that, you know, I really enjoy doing because in my mind and my hope, you know, I am helping to diversify the legal profession because that is something that, you know, the profession desperately needs.
Mm-hmm. And all that sounds really great. And, you know, it's a great point to end on because it leads me right into my next question, which is like for pre-law students and students who are interested in applying to law school, what are some factors that you think that they should look to when initially making the decision of, okay, what school do I apply to?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I'm in the process of writing my second book right now. And just last week, I worked on a section that was devoted to a question similar to this. And so some of the things that I tell people in the book is to ask themselves honest questions about what their particular preferences are. And so in terms of our preferences, in terms of, you know, their personal geographic desires, questions about, you know, what financial considerations they have. Do they need to live in a place that's, you know, more rural versus a large city because of rent considerations? What kind of law are you interested in? Are there schools that specialize in those areas of law or offer specialized classes in those areas? And then also, what career goals do you have, right? Because if you're somebody who has, you know, career goals, you want to work at a big law firm or you want to clerk after law school, then more likely than not, a law school's rank matters. And so does a law school's rank matter to you? Is it okay to go to a regional school versus a T14 school? Or is it okay to go to a lower ranked school versus a regional school? And so it's really a matter of your own personal preferences and what it is that you want out of your legal career. But thinking about those sorts of things in advance are going to help you narrow down your law school list. But it really is, the first step is to take a personal assessment of what your wants and needs are from your legal education and what your goals are, at least initially, when you start your legal career, and what sort of law school can help get you there, hopefully in the most cost-effective way possible.
Mm-hmm. And everything that you mentioned, I know it's definitely things that I took into account when I was applying to law school. I was definitely looking at, you know, okay, how many people from this school is getting a clerkship? How many people is going into big law? And then also, you know, where do I want to live and where do I not want to live? And all those different considerations that you mentioned, but I know kind of at the forefront of my mind and probably, you know, a lot of pre-law students and people who are applying to law school, whether they're coming straight out of undergrad or coming from, you know, a long and maybe not so long professional career, is GPA and LSAT, you know, the hard numbers. And then even now the GRE, and you're looking at, okay, what are the 25th, the median, 75th percentiles, and how should that factor into my analysis? So I'm just wondering, how much weight do you think students should give to those hard factors? And how does that analysis play into, you know, the other soft factors, such as your extracurriculars or maybe your long career and different things like that?
Yeah, another great question. So the reality is that numbers are hard factors are only one part of the law school admissions evaluation. They're a very important part. I will not lie about that. I would say that probably an admissions decision somewhere between 60 to 70% probably is determined by your hard factors. But 30 to 40% is not an insignificant number. So your soft factors, the rest of your application makes up the rest of your decision. And so that means that your numbers aren't the end all be all with regard to whether you'll be admitted or not. And so every year, sometimes I like to tell my clients this, every year law schools deny applicants with both numbers above their median and admit applicants with both numbers below their median. And so, you know, you can get into a law school without having those numbers. You can be denied from a law school when you do have those numbers. And so the point of me sharing that is really just to make clear that essentially applicants shouldn't place everything on their numbers. You know, they want to perfect the rest of their application package as well in order to give themselves the best shot of being admitted. So things like a good personal statement, a resume filled with past work experiences and extracurriculars, stellar letters of recommendation, all these things really can help someone stand out. And also when you're thinking about your hard factors, I think that there's a misconception that you have to have these numbers in order to get into a school. And I already talked just a second ago about how you can have both numbers below a median and possibly still get into a school. But if you are trying to put yourself in the best position, try to have at least one of the numbers, the median. So either a GPA or an LSAT score. Many people that get into law school every year are splitters. And so that is really where the bulk of matriculating students come from, that batch of splitters. And so don't put so much pressure on yourself to think that if you don't have these numbers that you can't get in, or that if you don't have both of these numbers, you can't get in, you know, because history just at every law school demonstrates that, you know, a median is just that. Half the students had above it, half the students that got in had below it. So do not be too hard on yourself when it comes to hard numbers, but definitely try to do the best you can to have as close to those medians as possible.
And we talked a little bit about soft factors. I know some people may or may not know what that is, but do you think you could give some examples of some soft factors that you've seen or some ones that are pretty common?
Yeah, definitely. So when I think of hard factors versus soft factors, I think of hard factors are as simply your quantitative factors. So those are just your numbers. And then your soft factors are all the qualitative factors. So everything besides your numbers. So when reading your letters of recommendation, what is this person's personality like? Are they going to be somebody that, you know, is going to contribute to the law school culture in a positive way? When looking at your resume and your work experiences and extracurriculars, is this going to be somebody that's going to contribute to the law school community in a positive way? Is this going to be somebody who is going to be employable after law school? And so all these things other than your numbers that demonstrate who you are besides just those numbers, who you are as a person, those are all your soft factors.
Okay, that sounds really great. And thank you for going into more detail about it. I know that some people know what they are and some people don't. So to everyone listening, they are now well apprised of what those soft factors are. And just like Akeisha said, you know, 30 to 40% is not an insignificant number. And I think sometimes pre-law students and other students applying to law school sometimes downplay their soft factors just because, like you said, they're splitters or maybe they're below both medians and different things like that.
Yeah.
One thing that you also talked about that I want to dive into is the personal statement. So can you talk about first what a personal statement is?
Yes. This one's a little tough because I have a personal grudge against law schools when it comes to a personal statement. Mm-hmm. I personally am of the belief that one of the injustices that happens in law school admissions is law schools aren't as forthcoming and transparent as they could be about what they want in a personal statement. And it's something that frustrated me tremendously when I worked in admissions. It's something that frustrates me still to this day, because I tend to find that the majority of people that apply to law school don't necessarily write great personal statements, but it's not always their fault. I tend to find that many law schools have personal statement prompts that are either misleading or overly broad or just intentionally vague or, yeah, just vague, whether intentional or not. And so in a nutshell, your personal statement is essentially the equivalent of your cover letter to a law school. And so regardless of what a law school prompt, personal statement prompt says, more likely than not, your personal statement needs to talk about what has led you to want to apply to law school, what has led you to want to be a lawyer. And so in my experience, even though many law schools don't just flat out say that, really what they want to know by the time they're done reading your personal statement is just that. Why do you want to go to law school? So what has led you to this point, or what has served as your catalyst? And what is your vision for yourself once you have your law degree? So what kind of law do you want to practice, or what kind of clients do you want to serve? And again, because in your personal statement, you've talked about what has led you here, there's probably a correlation between the type of clients that you want to serve and what has led you to want to go to law school. But this again is essentially your cover letter to law schools. As if you were applying to a job, what is it that, you know, has led you to this point? Some things that your personal statement is not, is it's not a recital of your resume. You can definitely touch on some things that are probably found in your resume, but it is more of a narrative. It's more of a document that needs to incorporate storytelling and some other things. And so it's not just a recital of your resume, but it does talk about, you know, what has led you to want to go to law school.
Mm-hmm. And when students are thinking about, you know, okay, if I'm just talking about what led me to go to law school, what if what led them to go to law school, you know, isn't anything significant or anything that they think is worth writing about? What would you say to those students about writing their personal statement and coming up with either unique ideas, or maybe it doesn't have to be unique, but being able to tell a story through their personal statement?
Yeah. So I like to tell clients not to cut themselves or not to, yeah, cut themselves short or think that what they have to say is insignificant, because the truth is your story in and of itself is usually more meaningful than you know. And so when I brainstorm topics with clients, I often make them think of, you know, moments that either led to their desire to want to be a lawyer or that confirmed that desire. And so that may be something that was as simple as, you know, I saw my mom or my parents being mistreated as a child. Even though that may seem like something really insignificant to you, it's still your why. And so your reason why is really the most important thing when it comes to your personal statement. And so although that may have seemed like something that was just really minor in your life, in this context is really big and is really important. And so those are often the things that your personal statement needs to be about, even if it doesn't feel, you know, overly significant. And so I do recommend, however, also with your personal statement, not to try to throw too much into it. So you don't want to have too many narratives. I try to recommend to stick to one or two narratives. So as you're brainstorming and you're thinking about, you know, those reasons why you want to go to law school, think about the two that you can explain in the most detail, because to the extent possible, you do want to take the reader back to those moments in time with you. So what were you experiencing and sensing? And so the ones that you have or that evoke the most emotion in you are probably going to be the ones that when somebody reads it, evokes the most emotion in them as well. So personal statements that tend to, you know, evoke emotion in the reader, usually evoked emotion in the writer, and those tend to be more powerful in my opinion. And so those are usually the topics that you want to go with.
Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about, you know, evoking emotion and making a memorable personal statement, you know, some students, they go back and forth on as to whether they should write about a personal trauma that they experienced or something that, you know, changed them and or something along those lines. How would you say those students should go about approaching those types of personal statements while still maintaining, you know, a sense of one, integrity, but also showing that, you know, they're not broken?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I like to at least tell my clients that you also, for most schools, have the option of writing a diversity statement as well. And so mm-hmm. sometimes those personal traumas or those moments of hardship, et cetera, are really good to talk about in a diversity statement. But when it comes to deciding whether it goes in a personal statement or a diversity statement, the question to ask yourself is really, did this lead to my desire to want to become an attorney? And so if the event in your life, you know, has a direct correlation to why you want to go to law school, then it probably is perfect for your personal statement. If it's just another, you know, experience that you've had that maybe isn't as strong as another story that you have. So for example, let's say that you are somebody who maybe experienced discrimination growing up because you grew up in the rural South and you're LGBTQ. That might be really good for a personal statement or a diversity statement. But if you're that person and you want to practice entertainment law and it has nothing to do with, you know, your sexual orientation, then it probably is better for a diversity statement instead of a personal statement. So I like to encourage clients to be, you know, transparent and vulnerable and honest about some of those things that they've experienced, to work it into their package somewhere if they feel comfortable sharing it. But it doesn't always have to be your personal statement. So kind of knowing the purpose of each different essay is really important, to know where exactly to work that in. And of course, if you don't feel comfortable working that in, or it feels too vulnerable, or it feels like something you don't want to disclose to an admissions committee, you don't have to. So you also have that level of agency to decide how much you disclose and how much you don't.
Mm-hmm. And talking about diversity statements, so we discussed a little bit about, you know, you said those personal traumas or hardships, there's definitely something that someone can write about in their diversity statement instead of their personal statement. And so kind of on the same topic, how can they amplify and talk about their diversity in that diverse, in that diversity statement without saying, you know, well, I'm Black, or, you know, well, I'm this. And so that's why you should let me in. So essentially, what does an effective diversity statement look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so you're right. A diversity statement shouldn't necessarily just say, like, hey, this is my diverse characteristic. Really, what I tend to find makes an effective diversity statement is talking about some of the challenges you've overcome or some of the hardships you've experienced. And so let's say that you want to disclose that, you know, as a Black woman in America, you have, you know, experienced more challenges than someone else. You probably do need to share a story of, like, an example of a challenge you've experienced. So maybe it's a story of a professor, you know, touching your hair and saying something inappropriate to you. Or maybe it's a story of being a Black man and being racially profiled and pulled over by a police officer. But you want to not just talk about that diverse characteristic, but you want to talk about how it has shaped some of your experiences in life. And so that is really the way that you kind of weave in your diverse characteristics. And so when it comes to, you know, the types of clients that I work with, usually first generation, low income or minority applicants, I find that there's often a level of shame or embarrassment about, you know, some of the hardships we've overcome. And so where that's because of imposter syndrome, or because, you know, we are so used to navigating classism and navigating racism, or, you know, just navigating just these different spaces where we have to code switch, we're taught not to talk about these things, or we're taught, you know, to talk about it in secret with our friends and family. But really amplifying your diversity effectively usually requires you to kind of turn off that instinct to code switch and really lay out who you are and what you've experienced in an authentic and sometimes vulnerable way. And so really those experiences that you've had as a result of these characteristics are what it is that you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about, you know, not code switching and trying to amplify your voice, and even going back to the personal statements, it sounds like a common and recurring theme here is storytelling and essentially being able to relate that story in your statement.
Yes, absolutely true. I think that storytelling is really the most powerful, one of the most powerful tools when you're putting together your application, because an admissions committee doesn't really, more often than not, they don't get the opportunity to actually meet you. And so to the extent that you're able to tell your story and narrative in a way that, you know, sticks with them versus something that's very, you know, sterile or just very formulaic, I think that it really stands out a bit more.
Mm-hmm. And when you're thinking about diversity statements as well, you know, more and more, diverse is having a broader and broader meaning. So not just, you know, minorities, but also LGBTQ, also sometimes I think I've seen, what is it, like rural areas, you know, women as well. And so in those situations, you have those types of people applying to law school. Should their diversity statement essentially be the same?
Yeah. So let me actually touch on that, because you just touched on a really good point. I think diversity statement is a bit of a misnomer. I think that there's a misconception that a diversity statement does have to talk about, you know, you being an ethnic or racial minority. But the truth is, I tend to think that, you know, it would be better for these essays to probably be referred to as a challenges or a resilience essay. And so really, you know, if you are somebody who has overcome or experienced any sorts of hardships, you probably are eligible to write a diversity statement. And so where that was growing up in poverty, experiencing, you know, some form of assault, witnessing domestic violence, or, you know, drug abuse growing up, being racially profiled or being discriminated against, all these things make for good diversity statements. The difference between your diversity statement and your personal statement, however, I mentioned about in your personal statement, you want to stick to one to two, you know, topics or narratives. With your diversity statement, you almost have the opportunity to write like a mini autobiography. You can take the reader back to your childhood, then take them to your teenage years, and then take them to your college years, and then where you are now. So you are able oftentimes with your diversity statement to work in a little bit more of your story in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming. But you definitely still want to keep that down to two pages or whatever school's limit is. So you don't want to take up too much space with your diversity statement, but you usually do, you know, want to follow some of those same rules with your, as your personal statement in terms of, you know, formatting of your document, et cetera, page limits, but, and anything else that the school says they want in terms of what your document should look like.
Mm-hmm. I like the way that you rethink or reformat the diversity statement in terms of more so thinking about it as challenges and resilience and overcoming obstacles. Because I think when you think about it that way, it makes it much easier to think about what you want to write about and, you know, tell a story, especially because with the word just diversity, you think, okay, well, I'm not really diverse, so I can't write anything here. Or like, even for Black women like myself and, you know, just other minorities, if we don't really have anything to say about our particular characteristic or our race, we're like, okay, I don't really know what to write here.
Absolutely. Yes.
So I think that I like how you just put it. And I think a lot of people will definitely take that and run with it as they're forming their application packages. And so another question that I have for you is, when do you think the best time to apply to law school is?
Yeah. So I usually like to tell my clients to try to get their applications in by Halloween. And I usually say Halloween. So that's the end of October, October 31st, because typically less applicants have applied by then. And so it's easier to stand out in a good way if you're one of those early people to get your application in. But honestly, even if you can apply by that time, the next window of, or the next time frame that I would recommend getting your applications in by is aiming for Thanksgiving. So that's the end of November, which is still likely a good time frame to put you ahead of most applicants. But worst case scenario, if you are not able to meet Halloween or Thanksgiving, it's perfectly okay if you apply by the end of December or early January, because that's typically in my experience when most applicants are putting their applications in. And so at that point, you are within that mass wave of applicants. And so you are right there with most people applying to law school. You aren't behind the curve. But however, after mid-January, I think that you're likely a little bit behind the curve, which does mean, which doesn't necessarily mean that you can't get in, but it does mean that the applicant pool is likely to be a lot more competitive. And so that's just something to factor in. So earlier in the cycle sometimes can be beneficial for applicants, whereas later in the cycle can be, you know, less beneficial for applicants.
And as we're talking about the application cycle, what are some mistakes that you've seen either with your clients or just when you were at UCLA that students should absolutely avoid when applying?
Now, that is a really big question. It could be a podcast episode all by itself. Just some general things just from each of those categories. I would say the biggest mistake when you're preparing for the LSAT is not spending enough time studying for the LSAT. So I definitely recommend that, you know, applicants spend at least 6 months to a year preparing for the LSAT before they apply to law school. When it comes to applying to law school, I think one of the biggest mistakes that applicants make is thinking that they have to have a school's median numbers to get in. And so they sometimes reject themselves from schools that they probably could have had a chance of being admitted to. And so that's, you know, a mistake that applicants make. And then I would say that probably when it comes to, you know, first generation low income and minority applicants, after hearing back from law schools, probably the biggest mistake that they make is not negotiating scholarships or even knowing that they can negotiate scholarships. So those are three mistakes that are very common that, you know, I definitely, you know, want people to avoid.
And that's wonderful. I think that's the perfect transition to my last question before I bring us into the final section. And that last question is simply, what advice would you give to all students or working professionals who are applying to law school?
Yeah, I think that oftentimes applicants that look like you and I, you know, struggle with imposter syndrome. I think that that's very common within our community and even within other minority communities. And so one piece of advice would definitely be believe in yourself. I think that more often than not, you know, minority, first generation, low income applicants are far more amazing than they even realize they are. And so really have faith in yourself. Also want to recommend really preparing for that LSAT seriously. Really, again, give yourself those 6 months to a year to study and try to get as high of a score as possible. But even if you're not able to get, you know, a 180, which is a perfect score, at the bare minimum, try to push yourself to get at least in the mid to high 150s, which will give you a better shot. For minority applicants, our LSAT average is usually a bit lower in the 140s, which, you know, doesn't mean you can't get into law school, but you have a much better shot at getting into better law schools and having scholarship packages, you know, the closer you are, or even if you're in the 160s. So definitely hitting those low or those mid to high 150s, you know, is definitely a goal to set for yourself if possible.
That's perfect. And I completely, I should say that I like the fact that you mentioned, you know, the differences in medians and scores between, you know, Black students and everyone else, essentially, because I think it's an important factor to take into consideration, especially as you're applying to law school and as law schools are actively trying to admit more and more diverse students.
Yeah.
Okay, Akeisha, so I'm going to bring us into the final section, which is just a set of final four questions. And I'd just like for you to say the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. How can law students, or I should say, I'm going to change this a little. How can pre-law students best set themselves up for success?
I would say follow your passion, follow the kinds of things that bring you joy. Also just be open to life working itself out and not always knowing, you know, ahead of time what your future will look like, but having faith in the journey and that you will end up where you need to be eventually.
And second question, how can attorneys find success in the workplace?
That one is difficult. And I think that depends on how every person defines success for themselves. And so for me, success probably looks more like having balance in my life. And so I think that in order to have balance in my life, I have to have firm boundaries with, you know, different things, how many hours I work in my day job versus, you know, how I spend time, you know, in my off hours. And so definitely know what success looks like for yourself. And then find those boundaries that you need to set in order to be able to live that life that looks successful to you.
Mm-hmm. And what is one person or one thing that every law student must have?
A strong support system. I think that is an absolute needed thing for any person, especially though, if you are going through law school and if you are in the legal profession. I think that having that tribe and those people that you can call when you want to cry or vent or give up is just essential in order to just survive and navigate in these spaces.
Mm-hmm. And finally, how did you relax while in law school?
I actually don't remember relaxing much in law school, but I would probably say that my form of incorporating self-care was finding things that were unrelated to law school in the community to do. And so, for example, I did some community activism work while I was in law school that was just really meaningful and important to me. And it took my mind off of being a law student. So finding those things that bring you joy outside and that take your mind outside of the law school and off of being a law student, I think is really important.
Yes, I can completely agree there. And Akeisha, I want to take the time to thank you so much for joining me today. You gave some wonderful information. And I know our listeners are going to find it incredibly helpful. So thank you.
You're so welcome. And thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Topping the Curve. All of Akeisha's information will be left in the show notes for you guys, and I encourage you guys to go check her out and definitely go see everything that she has to offer, especially for those of you considering applying to law school or currently crafting your law school application. As always, I encourage you guys to check out my website, www.sephoragray.com. We have mentorship opportunities, document review, and other opportunities that are on there available for you guys. Follow us on our website, follow us on Instagram, and follow us on Facebook. And I will see you guys on my next one. Thanks. Bye.